You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and informative daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and renewable markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the energy landscape.
Monday, January 24th, 2022. Sweet dreams are made of this. Midstreamers' critical role in the energy transition. Published by David Brazil. The shale revolution created an unprecedented need for midstream infrastructure of every sort. Gathering systems, processing plants, storage hubs, takeaway pipelines, fractionators, export terminals, and more, all with the aim of connecting new hydrocarbon supply to demand. Throughout the 2010s, the scope and urgency of this midstream build-out opened up tremendous opportunities for the master limited partnerships, private equity-backed developers, and other entities with the management skills, financial wherewithal, and dexterity to make these massive projects happen. Now, much of the shale era's required new infrastructure is in place, and COVID and ESG have slowed new project development to a crawl, putting many MLPs in a bind and leaving private equity firms to wonder where they should invest their money next. Well, there may be an even better set of new opportunities on the horizon, all related to the coming energy transition, and, as it turns out, midstream developers with hydrocarbon experience are uniquely positioned to lead the way. In today's RBN blog, we discuss how the project development model that drove the midstream sector's growth over the past decade is poised for potentially lucrative reuse in the 2020s and beyond. The midstream sector in the U.S. oil and gas industry has been evolving continuously since the 1820s and 30s, when natural gas was first piped to light street lamps in Fredonia, New York, and Philadelphia, and the 1850s, when oil produced in western Pennsylvania was shipped to market in wooden barrels on wagons and flatboats. By the 1860s, crude was moving by railcar and pipeline, and by the early 1890s the first long-distance gas pipeline was hauling gas 120 miles from central Indiana to Chicago. Soon thereafter, scientists and other folks started figuring out what to do with NGLs. American Gasoil Company, the first commercial marketer of propane, was established in 1912, though it took another 42 years for the first portable gas barbecue grill, with a 20-pound propane cylinder, to go on sale. The very definition of midstream also has been evolving as the industry becomes more complex and interconnected. Today, the midstream sector involves everything that happens between the wellhead and the point of consumption: gathering, treating, processing, transportation, trucks, railroads, pipelines, storage, fractionation, for NGLs, liquefaction, to make LNG, exporting, and marketing. Just as important to our discussion today, the types of corporate entities that actually do midstream has been changing too, especially over the past 3 or 4 decades. And, as we hinted at in our introduction, many of the midstreamers that now dominate the sector have the infrastructure development experience, financial resources, and entrepreneurial spirit to play major, if not leading, roles in developing the wide variety of projects, renewable fuels, hydrogen, ammonia, carbon capture and sequestration, etc., that will drive the coming transition to a lower carbon world. We'll start with a quick look at how the midstream sector has morphed over our lifetimes. As recently as the 1980s, much of the U.S.'s midstream infrastructure was developed, owned, and operated by major integrated oil and gas companies and, on the gas side, big gas utilities. Sure, there were independents and other, smaller players in the mix, but by and large, midstream assets were concentrated in relatively few hands. That changed, though, when the majors started divesting many of their U.S. assets, especially their midstream holdings, either to spin-off companies or others. That trend helped to create a new class of companies, midstreamers, that through the 1990s and 2000s assembled portfolios of pipelines and other midstream assets and augmented those with new projects. Some were publicly owned corporations, a few were privately held, but, for good reasons we'll get to next, an increasing number were master limited partnerships, or MLPs. As we said in Masters of the Midstream, MLPs are a type of U.S. corporate structure first used in 1981. Federal tax reform legislation in 1986 limited the use of MLPs to entities involved in real estate, commodities, or natural resources infrastructure. More on this in a minute. MLPs are partnerships that trade on public exchanges, and because a partnership is not a corporation, an MLP pays no corporate taxes on its profits. Instead, tax liabilities are passed through to individual unit holders, who pay tax on their share of the MLP's profits at their individual tax rate. This avoids double taxation, the situation in which a traditional corporation pays corporate taxes and shareholders pay taxes on the dividends they receive from the company, and gives MLPs a cost of capital advantage over their corporate brethren. For this and other reasons, the MLP structure has played a critical role in supporting the development of U.S. pipelines and midstream infrastructure, especially during the boom years of the shale era. We noted just before that, under the federal tax code, an MLP has to be involved in real estate, commodities, or natural resources infrastructure. More precisely, energy-related MLP needs to receive at least 90% of its income from specific qualifying activities involving certain natural resources. Qualifying natural resources include crude oil, natural gas, and petroleum products, as well as coal, timber, industrial-sourced carbon dioxide, or CO2, which was added to the list in 2008, and ethanol, biodiesel, and other alternative fuels, also added in 2008. Qualifying natural resources activities under the tax code include exploration and production, mining, gathering and processing, refining, compression, transportation, storage, marketing, distribution, and propane retail sales. A short sidebar, the logic behind operating these types of business as MLPs is that they, unlike, say, E&Ps, tend to produce reliable, consistent streams of income. The toll road analogy is often used to describe the MLP business model because income is derived from the volume of traffic using an asset, such as a pipeline, a fractionator, or an export terminal, rather than the actual production and sale of commodity assets. The steady cash income from these assets theoretically enables an MLP to pay out predictable cash distributions to unitholders every quarter, sometimes referred to as clipping coupons. The shale revolution presented tremendous opportunities to MLPs. With hydrocarbon production taking off in the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, the Marcellus Utica, and other shale basins, including, don't forget, the Permian, there was an urgent need for oil and gas gathering systems, processing plants, takeaway pipelines, you name it. And midstream MLPs, with their experienced management, advantaged access to capital, and eagerness to make a lot of money, jumped in with 2 feet, and through the 2010s built out much of the infrastructure that the industry depends on today. The only problem, if you can call it that, was that there was simply too much work to be done. The MLPs that dominated the midstream sector could only do so much. They needed an assist, a farm team, if you will, to develop smaller projects they could later acquire, and they got it from what became a growing cadre of private equity-backed midstream developers that were all too happy to help. Typically, developers backed by private equity, PE, were and are headed by teams of experienced midstream executives anxious for a chance to run their own shops and make their mark. They researched the production areas that were growing fastest and specific midstream needs within them. Then, often with long-term contracts from producers, hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars in backing from PE firms, and almost always equity participation from management, they built out major projects, got them up and running like fine-tuned machines, and started looking for chances to flip them to others, usually MLPs, for a hefty profit. For the most part, MLPs and PE-backed developers kept busy until the late 2010s, when production growth started to slow, the urgency for more midstream infrastructure eased, and the MLP model, powered in many ways by nonstop expansion, faltered. PE-backed developers also took a hit, no surprise there, really, given that their success had been based to a large degree on their ability to develop, operate, and flip their projects to an eager, even frenetic set of potential buyers. If you're selling, whether it's a house in a hot neighborhood or a gathering system in the Midland, a bitter war is a godsend for midstreamers. The frenzy had slowed and, with the arrival of COVID-19 in the spring of 2020, it pretty much ground to a halt. With the modest recovery in hydrocarbon production over the past several months, there's been a rebound in deal-making. Check out our buy blog for more on that, including acquisitions to expand midstream holdings in the best, most lucrative production areas. See our recent blog on Enterprise's planned purchase of Navitas Midstream and its natural gas gathering and processing network in the Permian's Midland Basin. As we see it, though, the new growth area for MLPs and PE-backed companies with midstream skills over the next few years will relate to the energy transition. You might be wondering, what's the link between the midstream sector and the drivers of the lower carbon economy like renewable fuels, hydrogen, ammonia, and carbon capture and sequestration? In fact, the energy transition is all about the midstream, gathering, processing, transporting, and even exporting the energy sources of the next generation. We'll discuss all that in upcoming blogs. In the next episode in this series, we'll delve into what makes the PE-based management team model such a potent player in this space. Sweet Dreams Are Made of This was written by Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart and appears as the sixth song on the Eurythmics' second studio album of the same name. Released as a single in January 1983, the song went to number one on the Billboard Hot 100 Singles chart and became the Eurythmics' breakthrough hit. It has been certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America, RIAA. The song has been covered by a few artists, including JX Writers featuring Skylar Stecker, which went to number one on the Billboard Dance Club Songs chart, as well as Swing featuring Dr. Alban and Marilyn Manson, whose version went to number 26 on the Billboard Alternative Airplay chart. Personnel on the Eurythmics' record were Annie Lennox on vocals and synthesizer, and Dave Stewart on synthesizers, drum machine, and programming. The album Sweet Dreams Are Made of This was recorded during 1982 at the Eurythmics 8-track home studio and at the Church Studio in North London. Produced by Dave Stewart, the album was released in January 1983 and went to number 15 on the Billboard 200 Albums chart. It has been certified gold by the RIAA. Four singles were released from the LP. The Eurythmics were a British new wave pop duo formed in Wagga Wagga, Australia, in 1980 by Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart. Both were previously in the band The Tourists, which broke up in 1980. They released their debut album, In the Garden, in October 1981 to very little success. With a number one hit single, Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, from their second album, the duo went on to produce a string of hit singles and LPs before breaking up in 1990. They released 8 albums, 1 live album, 1 soundtrack album, 2 compilation albums, 1 EP, and 33 singles. The Eurythmics have won 4 ASCAP awards, 1 Brit Award, 1 Grammy Award, 4 Ivor Novello Awards, and 1 MTV Video Music Award, and have sold over 75 million records worldwide. The duo briefly reunited in 1999 and released the studio album, Peace. Both Lennox and Stewart have gone on to solo careers. Lennox has released 6 studio albums, 1 compilation album, and 23 singles. Stewart has released 9 studio albums and 9 singles. He is also actively involved in film, television, and soundtrack work.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.